let me know when we get close to the end. Maggie, Eric asked me to do a simulation of Maggie, and I'm really pleased I did it, so I think it's turned out to be a very interesting case. So I'm going to show you some preliminary results from that this morning. I'm going to first review some maps that show a cooling response to Maggie. We can go through these quickly because we've seen parts of this already. Eric's first analysis of Maggie's winds, which are very interesting. An ocean model simulation from these winds and indicate a few of the waves that Maggie may be new and interesting. Let's see, so I'm going to run through SST maps that show the passage of Maggie. But notice I've already put Phanom-Phi's track on this map because I think Phanom-Phi's track is going to show up in about 3 weeks when Maggie comes through again. So these data are at daily intervals, fairly high resolution, and I think they're fairly bug-free. So let's step through a time series of these. So that's, this is pre-Maggie, and here comes Maggie. Not much yet, but as it goes through this area just south of Phanom-Phi's track, it starts to make what looks like a cool wave. It's moving very fast at that time. Goes through the South China Sea where it makes a big wake. Over the next week or so, it starts to disappear, but never completely because it was so late in the season that you can see the onset of seasonal cooling, especially north. But even down this far, and so features start to show up in the SST map that look like the onset of seasonal cooling. So there's a quick look at Maggie SST maps. Now this is a 3-day average prior to the passage of Maggie. This is 3 days after Maggie with about 2 days in the middle to allow the hurricane to go through. And if we difference these two maps, we get an estimate of the cooling that you see there. And I'm going to sample it along those lines that are running across the track. And we get a picture that looks like this. So this is the SST change post minus pre Maggie. And notice the scale is pretty expanded here. So this is somewhere around here is zero. Well, I don't see it. Zero is the solid line that runs across the top. Just there, and the scale goes down to just about 2.5. So the cooling induced by Maggie was actually fairly modest. You can read it off, it has an amplitude of about 1.1 degrees C. The maximum cooling is at about 50 kilometers to the right of the track, plus or minus 20 or 30. And the width, which is something we'll talk about again in a minute, if you measure it by the half amplitude of the cooling, was about 240 kilometers. So we can make a pretty objective and straightforward estimate of the cooling. Now, I pointed out the obvious cooling by Maggie, which is this nice dip that you see here. But if you go towards the north far enough, just a few hundred kilometers, you start to find some profiles in that set that show cooling that occurred during the passage of Maggie. And I suspect, but I don't know this for sure, that that is the leftover wake of Phanom-Phi. So Phanom-Phi's track had disappeared, wake had disappeared in SST, but likely it was just a fairly thin, 10 or 15 meter thick warm layer. And when the winds of Maggie came along, even at a distance of 200 or 300 kilometers, they're still substantial, would mix it down and show the wake of Phanom-Phi all over again. So this is about a month after the passage of Phanom-Phi. Now I don't know for sure that that's the Phanom-Phi wake, but it certainly looks to me like it could be. So that may be another estimate of how long the subsurface wake lasted, quite a while. Now, Eric has made a first analysis of the Maggie winds, and I'm just reproducing a figure that he provided me. And if you look at the scales in latitude and longitude, you can see that the highest winds of Maggie were confined over quite a narrow region. And if we just take the wind speed and fit it to a function of radius, which I've done here, the black solid line, then you end up placing the radius to maximum winds at about 13 kilometers. Well, that's very small. The amplitude, however, is quite large, 63 3 or 64 meters per second, and with some even higher than that. And so I think we could say that Meggy was a very intense, but also very small storm. And here's a comparison with Francis from 2004 and Meggy 2010. And I've just listed a few of the parameters that are relevant in determining the ocean response. And translation speed is very important. Both of them were moving fairly quickly. Meggy at 7 meters per second. The typhoon radius is the most, perhaps the most remarkable thing. With Francis, it was about 35 kilometers, which I would say is fairly common. With Meggy, it was 13, which is quite small. Now that has the consequences that, first of all, coupled with this vast movement, that Meggy was present over any part of the ocean for only a few hours, maybe 6 hours or so, depending on how you measure it. And in terms of the non-dimensional storm speed, which is the inertial period divided by the residence time, Francis was about 1, which is again fairly typical. That means that there'll be a fairly pronounced rightward asymmetry in resonance with inertial motions. But Meggy was about 6, so in this sense, she was moving very, very quickly. The second aspect of this is the coupling that results between the wind-driven mixed layer and the thermocline beneath. And one way to measure that is a mixed layer Berger number, G prime H over 4 R squared F squared. And that's roughly the ratio of the pressure gradient induced by Beckman, I probably should call it inertial pumping, divided by the Coriolis force acting on the wind-driven current. For Francis, it was about 0.6. For Meggy, it was a whopping 8. So that has big significance for the response in the subsurface ocean, Meggy, which we'll see in just a second. So Meggy was quite different from Francis in a very interesting case, I think. Let's see. So this is I'll go through this quickly. This just shows the wind stress amplitude, which was just computed from one of the wind speed saturated drag coefficients given the radial profile of the wind. That's at best a first cut to the stress. I'm sure there's much more to it than that. And the bottom figure shows the stress magnitude over again. The current, which doesn't look like much, and tau dot u. So in the front half of the storm, the strong wind stress accelerated the currents, but then the wind stress switched direction so quickly that the currents couldn't keep up, and so there was a pronounced negative tau dot u, negative wind work, just in the rear half of the storm. So the total residence time would be on the order of 6 hours or so, very quick. Although it's not just a number, there's several ways you can measure that. Okay, we said that. Now, here's a simulation run with that steadily translating vortex model of Meggy's winds, run over the 3D PWP model. And I've written preliminary on all these because these presentations have a way of finding their way onto the web. And I think we can be fairly confident that over time we're going to come up with a much more nuanced picture of Meggy's stress than I had at this point. And the stress, of course, is extremely important for the ocean response. And so parts of this, I think we have to take rather cautiously. But here's the pattern of sea surface temperature looking down with the storm just right here and moving up the page. So this is behind the storm. This is obviously ahead of it. So you can see a nice cool wave off to the right. The maximum cooling was about 0.8 degrees C. That compares with 1.1 that was observed. The maximum cooling was about 30 kilometers to the right of the track versus about 50 from the observations. And the half width is at 160 versus about 240. So I would conclude that this wake is slightly weaker and slightly narrower than was the observed wake of Meggy. Now, the amplitude, I think, is going to change when we get a better estimate of the stress. It could go down, for all I know, but it may go up. The size may change a little bit, too. But I think there's no question that Meggy was intense, no doubt about that, and very small, no doubt about that either. So let's look at some things that follow from that. So we're going to slice this solution along three lines at x equals 0, right along the track, 30 and 90 kilometers. And so this is a sliced glial solution. And you can see with time running from minus one to the storm passage to about 2 days, and this shows the change in the sea surface temperature along the track as the storm went by, about 0.8 degrees C cooling. But the interesting thing, I think, is this really intense upwelling. Around 40 meter amplitude at peak, but with a constant offset of perhaps half that, maybe 20 meters. So that's large upwelling, and it occurs on a small spatial scale. These are the profiles of temperature on the left and salinity on the right. The initial conditions, this red line that you see here. And so the cooling shows up as this change from there to there, about 0.7 along the track. The upwelling is really easy to see here. This is the difference between this profile and that one, say, about 50 meters in places. And an interesting thing happens after the storm passes, and within the stratified transition layer, not the mixed layer, there's a change in the shape of the profile, which you can see here and here. And those are mixing events caused by the large shear of inertial motions propagating down into the thermal line and reaching a critical value, which initiates mixing in this model. So we can see shear-driven diathermal mixing occurring below the mixed layer in this model solution. I would imagine we'll see something like that in observations too, but we'll find out. This is the east and north velocity. I think I'm going to switch to the next one. The next one is a slice along 30 kilometers. So this is kind of along the, not quite, but close to the edge of the upwelling. And so there's very large pressure gradient here. And the consequence of this is that inertial motion propagates into the thermocline very, very quickly, within the first half of an inertial period. And the result is something I've never seen before in these kinds of data, a very large phase shift in the vertical that happens within the first half cycle of the response. Now that goes along with that very large Burger number. So normally, I think we can imagine if you try to build up a picture of what the currents look like, you would first of all think that they're in inertial motion, and then second, they're modified by pressure gradients that cause wave-like behavior, including propagation down and away. In this case, the pressure gradient coupling is so large that it's almost a wave from the beginning. I'm not sure that inertial motion is a very good, even first approximation in this case. This is at 90 kilometers. It looks very different, just a little ways away. There's still significant inertial motions generated. We don't see any vertical phase difference at this location. And I suspect that's because the motion's already way down into the mid-term plane at this point. All right, preliminary comments on Maggie. Very small and fast moving, non-dimensional storm speed was about 6. And partly as a consequence of that, there's little SST cooling. The ocean initial condition also played a part. The T100 was relatively high here. And so even if there is a lot of mixing, there won't be too much cooling of SST just because of that. A striking thing is the strong coupling between the surface layer and the thermocline that we can anticipate based on that very large mixed layer Burger number, the very large currents in the thermocline within the first day, large phase changes in the vertical that should be readily detectable, and shear-driven mixing within the interface layer. Now, there's a lot that needs to be done. We're all supposed to pony up something. Well, I'll send these MATLAB script and the data to the ITOP server if anybody wants to use it. But what I want to do too is something I don't even need to mention. I encourage along a reliable Linstress field for Maggie, but that's for the SAR and the meteorologist to do. Analyze the inertial wave weight made by Maggie, I think, would be a striking feature. Internal tides, I don't have them in here now, but maybe they belong in there. I'd be very interested to know what they might do. I didn't mention it, but there are interesting patterns in the SST fields that show up at other times than Earth typhoon passages. And I think with all the data we have, then we might be able to make some sense of that. Thank you.
Eric. You know, the wake is so small that your objective, and there were basically no good notice images, that objective analysis. microwave, which can't resolve the wake. So I don't think, I think the more accurate, it's just as likely that the observed quote is wider than the real because it doesn't have the resolution. See it. The shipboard data suggests that too.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't dispute the shipboard data.
Back
there. It looked like relatively more people in India
had the shipboard
passage. Is that correct? I'm sorry, Vince, I didn't quite hear that. Yeah, unlike Francis, most people in here seem to come before the passage. Well, there's not a whole lot as it goes by, and that's because, at least in the model, and I bet it happens in the ocean too, tau dot B, the windward, goes negative because the wind flips direction so quickly. And so, to the extent that vertical mixing is driven by the current, then mixing would stop. I doubt it stops. It slows down. But yes, you're right. Did you have a question?
You observed the upwelling, quite significant upwelling, but the translation speed was fast.
Very fast.
But so, because...
It may not have affected...
Yes.
It may not have affected the mixed layer cooling very much, because I think it outran it. The first peak in the upwelling is about a half a day after the storm passage, but the acceleration of the winds have long since stopped. So I suspect that it doesn't affect the sea surface temperature response. But it, of course, it's everything to do with what happens afterwards for the spreading of the wake.
What did you do for initial conditions for the vertical profile? Where did you get that from?
There were versions of it floating around, including on from the EM Apex, measured it, and EE showed some samples of Argo data. So it was very simple with a 40 meter mix layer and then a constant gradient below that. One more?
Just remind you about the AXTQE data taken right after the song. That should help find the way to the point nicely.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Okay, we should move on. Next is Dr. Ho. He'll be talking about typhoon impacts on the Western Pacific, internal tides, and the rest is caught up here.
All right, I'm going to talk about what we have.